Eisenhower wasn't being flexible, he wasn't being imaginative. Kennedy was going to fight fire with fire. Eisenhower was unwilling to send U.S. troops into the jungle because he was worried about what would happen. We're going to get sucked into a major Asian land war that we won't be able to win, just like in Korea. But this time it might not settle in a stalemate, it might settle in our defeat. Kennedy didn't have any qualms about fighting a land war in Asia. He was a doer. And so Vietnam fit nicely into this. But most importantly, Kennedy agreed that Vietnam represented a key Cold War battleground. That if you're going to contain China, you have to do so in Vietnam. Because of where Vietnam is located, because of what Vietnam represents not only to the US, but also to the People's Republic of China. It's not so much about containing the Soviet Union as it is about containing Communist China. And so Kennedy escalated the Vietnam War. And he did so even as he was... Kennedy escalated the Vietnam War even as he was de-escalating the Cold War. I quoted from Kennedy's January 1961 inaugural address where you pay any price, bear any burden, support any friend, that sort of thing. In June of 1963, Kennedy gave a very famous speech in American University in Washington, D.C., where he said, "We have to learn to live with the Soviets. The Soviets are just like us. They're people who have the same basic needs. They respond to the same pressures. They might be communists, but they generally have the same desires of peace and security that we do. Even though we disagree on the world's most important questions, we have to find a way to get along." What happened in the meantime, what happened in the interim between pay any price and can't we all just get along in those 2.5 years? Two major crises in Berlin and Cuba. The Berlin crisis in 61-62 when the Berlin Wall was built, and the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 62. Yes?
Just repeat the speech.
It was in June of 63, and it was, I forget what it was actually called, but historians know it as the American University speech. And it was a speech in American University, a commencement address in Washington, D.C., where he decided to de-escalate the Cold War. And that's in response to the Soviet Union and the United States coming to the brink of nuclear war, first in 1961 and then really in October of 62 with the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's not a great film, but if you want to get a sense of what the missile crisis was about and the tension that it involved, you should see the movie 13 Days. How many of you have seen it? Just two people. Well, it's not a fantastic movie. It's not something that you should have rushed out at the time to see. And of course, you were probably 12 years old at the time when it came out. But it's a good movie, and it certainly gives you a sense of the tensions involved and just how close the world came to nuclear destruction. And so Kennedy and Khrushchev, the leader of the Soviet Union, decided at that point, okay, we can disagree on certain issues, but we have to learn to manage our rivalry, or else the world isn't going to exist. We're going to destroy the world. We just have to do this. Interestingly, though, Vietnam, unlike Berlin and Cuba, nuclear weapons were never a part of Vietnam, were never a part of the battle in Vietnam. They were never a part of the conflict. They weren't even ever a part of the diplomacy of the Vietnam War. There were never any nuclear missiles stationed in Vietnam. Commanders on either side never threatened to use them, at least not at this time. And so if you're going to begin to bargain with the Soviets in Cuba and in Europe, if you want a way to show that you're not a pushover anymore, that you've still got it, and you want to prove your toughness in a place where it's relatively safe to do so, where you know you're not going to end up in nuclear war, it's Vietnam. And so Vietnam then becomes a place for Kennedy to test American resolve, to say, yes, we'll bargain with you elsewhere, Cuba and Europe, but you know, we're not a pushover. You can't get your way everywhere in the world. You've still got to think about us. And so Vietnam then becomes important symbolically as a way to prove American resolve, but also ironically as a way to support this softening of relations between the U.S. and the USSR. In the meantime, South Vietnam itself was a mess, an absolute mess. The South Vietnamese army was unable to sustain battle against the Viet Cong. Politically, the government in Saigon, the Diem regime, was unstable. and corrupt and becoming increasingly repressive, especially Catholics against the Buddhists. And in 1963, basically in a dispute, thank you, over religious freedom, Buddhists began rioting, protesting, first in Hue, which is the ancient imperial capital, and then all through South Vietnam, but especially in Saigon. It's from the Buddhist crisis, by the way, that you have some of the most famous images of the war, which are the self-immolation of Buddhist monks. It's one of those images where Buddhist monks sit down very calmly and meditate and are doused with gasoline and then lit on fire in protest. And it's incredibly famous. It's one of those images, not quite like the image of Che Guevara that you see on t-shirts, because nobody wants to walk around with a t-shirt of a guy burning himself to death. But you see it all the time as a statement of protest. It was on the cover of a Rage Against the Machine album. It's on the cover of other protest posters and books and so on and so forth. And this was in response, not necessarily to American foreign policy, but it certainly was in response to America's client, its ally in Saigon, that was seen as repressing the Buddhists. And so South Vietnam was a mess. It was losing the war, and the United States felt it had to do something. And so it sponsored a coup, an overthrow of Diem. And Diem was overthrown by a group of South Vietnamese army generals on November 1st, 1963. And 3 weeks later, John Kennedy was shot by Lee Harvey Oswald, and maybe others, nobody knows, although I think Oswald acted alone. JFK himself was shot November 22nd, 63, in Dallas, Texas. And these two deaths of the leader in South Vietnam and the leader in the United States, almost simultaneously, I mean in world historical terms, and certainly simultaneously, had the effect of committing the United States even further to South Vietnam. And for me, if you're to pick a time when, you know, things, inevitability is a dirty word among historians. Nothing is really ever inevitable. But if you're to pick a moment when the United States makes some crucial decisions that make a Vietnam War much more likely than peace, this is it. The United States sponsored the overthrow of Diem. That was the worst-kept secret in the diplomatic world. Everybody knew it. Everybody in Vietnam certainly knew it. And what's important is the regime that succeeded Diem was even more corrupt and even more inept than Diem was. These guys had the distinction of making Diem look like, look like he really was the Winston Churchill of Asia. In Washington, the key thing that happened was John Kennedy was succeeded by Lyndon Johnson, LBJ, one of the most interesting politicians you will ever study. And I could give a 90-minute lecture just on LBJ's personality, just by telling crazy stories about the things he used to do, and just how bombastic he was, and how insecure he was, and how ambitious he was, and also how idealistic he was. He's an absolutely incredibly fascinating individual. The only American politician who rivals LBJ for his, you know, as being somebody who's interesting because he was such a dysfunctional person, personality, is Richard Nixon, who's also incredibly interesting, and I'll talk about him in a minute. Anyway, Johnson inherited the Kennedy legacy, and he immediately decided that he wouldn't be the first president to lose a war. Instead of, a lot of people in Washington at this time had their doubts about Vietnam, and instead of launching a full-scale, reinvestigation, reevaluation of America's policy in Vietnam, Johnson, the first thing he did was he told his advisors, "I will not be the first president to lose a war." And he kept all of Kennedy's advisors in place, all of the main ones. Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, the Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, the National Security Advisor, McGeorge Bundy. He kept them all in place. These guys were all in favor of going to war, and, of course, they were telling the new president that they were in favor of going to war. And crucially, the new president was not as adept, Johnson was not as adept in foreign policy as John Kennedy was. And so he declared, he immediately decided he would not be the first president to lose a war. Once you make that decision, "I'm not going to be the first president to lose a war," you're effectively saying, "I'm not going to withdraw, no matter what." You're putting your cards on the table at the very outset. And so these two deaths have this effect of deepening America's involvement, I would say irrevocably, of deepening America's involvement. Johnson said he didn't want to be the first president to lose a war, but lose it he did. The questions I'd like to look at now, or briefly, are why did he decide to intervene? Why did it drag on for so long? And why he lost? Into 1964, early 65, the situation in South Vietnam continued to deteriorate. Once Diem was overthrown, Diem had been leader in South Vietnam since 1954, for 9 years. Once he was overthrown, it's as if everybody said, okay, now that we've overthrown the king once, we can do it whenever we feel like it, whenever we think that this government isn't doing well enough. And there was a revolving door of leaders in South Vietnam through the end of 63, all through 64, and into 65. It's one after the other. It's a trivia question that half a dozen people in the world can answer. Name all the presidents of South Vietnam from the overthrow of Diem until June of 65. The situation in South Vietnam continued to deteriorate. In 1964, remember, North Vietnam has been supplying South Vietnam, supplying the Viet Cong. Towards the end of 64, it makes a crucial decision to actually get involved in the fighting itself. And North Vietnam begins to send not just food and weapons and guns and advisors, it begins to send actual troops down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And so the situation in South Vietnam is deteriorating, North Vietnam is escalating, and it seems that there's going to be a collapse of non-communist rule in South Vietnam. That if the United States doesn't increase its commitment drastically, that it's going to have to withdraw whether it wants to or not. Just like what was happening to France in 1954. The difference is that the United States in 1964-65 was immensely more powerful than France was in 1954. And if it decides that it doesn't want to see South Vietnam lose, then go down the drain, then it has the resources to prevent that from happening. And that's exactly what they decided to do. Large-scale bombing, an operation very appropriately named Rolling Thunder. Large-scale bombing of North Vietnam, that is, began in February of 1965. In Vietnam, in the Vietnam War, from 1965 until 1973, the United States would drop more bombs on just Vietnam than all bombs were dropped in all of World War II by every single country. So every single bomb dropped in World War II by every single country was less than what the U.S. dropped on Vietnam. And that began in February of 1965. That's why when you go to Vietnam today and you're traveling through the countryside, you see these hundreds of craters all over the very flat landscape, all through here, near the coast. Rich, very rich agricultural land where they grow a lot of rice. Vietnam is one of the world's largest exporters of rice. But these rice paddies are now, as I said, dotted with bomb craters that are now ponds and lakes and whatnot. So Rolling Thunder began in February 65. Interestingly, it failed almost immediately. The United States began bombing North Vietnam for two reasons. One, in order to save the South, in order to sort of prove to the South that the U.S. was in it for the long haul, and so the South Vietnamese government could get its act together. And it also did it to punish North Vietnam, to get it to stop sending men and supplies, and women, men, women, and supplies down into South Vietnam. And both objectives failed. The political situation in South Vietnam did not stabilize. This show of American determination did nothing in Saigon, the capital of South Vietnam. And it did almost nothing to dent the North Vietnamese VC commitment to the war. North Vietnam, first of all, bombing, large-scale bombing like that usually doesn't work anyway. That was proven more or less conclusively in World War II, that Allied bombing of Germany and German bombing of Britain did almost nothing to actually change the course of battle. But in the case of North Vietnam, it was even more pointless because North Vietnam had almost no industry. It was mostly rural, mostly agricultural. It was covered by either rice paddies or jungle that you couldn't eradicate entirely. And, you bomb a rice paddy, well, the bomb crater fills up with water and you can dirt and water, and you can continue farming it. So it's not like you can blow up cities, you can blow up industrial complexes, factories, that sort of thing. So the bombing did very little damage to North Vietnam, certainly nothing to convince North Vietnam to stop waging the Vietnam War. Once the bombing campaign that began in February of 65 failed, it was just a foregone conclusion that the U.S. would send in troops. Johnson had committed so much American prestige to Vietnam that to begin bombing on that scale and then just to all of a sudden decide, well, it didn't work, we're going to go home now, is unrealistic and infeasible. And so the Vietnam War, at the very latest, troops are introduced in March 65. They're introduced finally, officially, in July of 65 by the tens of thousands. So at the very latest, the Vietnam War begins in July 65. And through these decisions, Johnson was motivated more or less by the same concerns that John Kennedy was. They've changed slightly, but they're the same. Important is the Cold War, still. Vietnam is important for what it represents. But the domino theory has changed slightly. It's gone from a physical, geographical domino theory to a psychological domino theory, meaning that American credibility is now on the line. America has staked its prestige to the survival of South Vietnam. If it lets South Vietnam go now, so the thinking in Washington went, who's going to trust our word? And people like Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State, said, if we don't support South Vietnam, if we turn tail and run, then why would Germany trust our word in Europe? You know, and if we leave South Vietnam, then NATO will begin to dissolve. It won't go, Britain and France and Italy and Germany won't go communist, but they won't trust our word anymore. Credibility also mattered in domestic politics. Again, Johnson was not only a Democrat, he was a liberal Democrat on domestic issues. He wanted to launch what he called the Great Society. At the center of the Great Society was civil rights for African Americans. But also, Johnson wanted to bring in Medicare and Medicaid, important health care reforms. Not quite an NHS, but something approaching an NHS. He wanted educational reform, housing reform. This is a very, very, very ambitious domestic reform program to help the poorest and most vulnerable in society. So Johnson is not only a Democrat, he's a liberal Democrat. He is, in the eyes of his enemies in the mid-60s, a socialist. And there was only one dirtier word in American politics than socialist in the 1960s, and that was communist. So the argument goes, in order to protect his Great Society from his conservative critics, he had to placate them in Vietnam. Again, it's kind of a quid pro quo. This conversation never happens, but it's effectively Johnson saying to the conservatives, okay, you can have your war in Vietnam as long as you don't try and sabotage my Great Society at home. The irony is that by going to war in Vietnam, Johnson ensured that his Great Society would never succeed, because both needed an awful lot of money. And if you're fighting a war, there are matters of life and death versus, oh, I want to build some new schools for poor people. At the end of the day, if something has to be cut, it's going to be your domestic reform program. So that's the tragedy of Lyndon Johnson. He may have been trying to protect the Great Society, but really all he did was ensure that it died. Finally, why else did Johnson go to war? He was known as the master of the Senate. He'd been a senator before becoming Kennedy's vice president, and then he succeeded to the presidency when Kennedy was shot. And, before becoming vice president, he'd been, as I said, the master of the Senate, a very powerful senator who got things done, who compromised, who brokered deals, and he saw foreign policy as essentially deal-making. In 1965, he gave a really famous speech at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, where he pledged $1 billion, a lot of money now, but a lot more back then, $1 billion to develop the Mekong, which is the river in the south of, comes down like this, and here's the Mekong Delta, which is incredibly rich farming land. And Johnson pledged to develop the Mekong, to put a big hydroelectric dam, that sort of thing, to make Vietnam prosperous. If only, this was his deal to Ho Chi Minh. He said, if you call off the insurgency, then America, I'll pledge however much money you want. Johnson wanted to bring a great society to Vietnam. That's what he said. And in fact, after he made the speech, he turned to one of his aides and he said, old Ho can't turn me down now. But what Johnson didn't realize is that foreign policy isn't like domestic politics. You can compromise in domestic politics on certain things. You can say, look, if you compromise on this bill to cut military funding. And if you hold military funding, then I'll support you in something that you want. I'll support you in your drive to build new schools in your district. I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine. But in foreign policy, you can't do that. You can't do that on questions of national self-determination, nationalism. You can't do that on things like capitalism or communism. That's the whole reason why the United States was at war with North Vietnam. They couldn't compromise on the fate of South Vietnam. What is South Vietnam going to be? Is it going to be an independent, non-communist country, the United States said, something it was absolutely unwilling to negotiate over? Or was it going to be part of a reunified whole, a reunified Vietnam that was going to be led by a socialist government in Hanoi? And that's something that the North Vietnamese and the VC were absolutely unwilling to compromise on. So you can't, these are things you can't broker. So the United States and North Vietnam found its, the United States and South Vietnam on one side and North Vietnam on the other side found themselves at war from 1965 onwards. The origins of the war, as we've seen, are much deeper, but the war itself began now. The war stalemated fairly quickly. In a nutshell, the United States had a poor strategy. It had a great power, it was basically trying to fight a great power war, a big set piece, big showpiece war against, you know, insurgents that were fighting a small scale war. It was looking to kill as many VC as possible, and that's how it measured success in the body count. This is where body count begins to become a notorious phrase. Kill ratio was another way that they would determine success. If we kill 10, 15, 20 VC for every American death, then we're winning the battle. But the Vietnamese could replace their numbers a lot more quickly and a lot more effectively than the United States could. They were fighting a low-tech war where it didn't take a long time to train new recruits and replacements. They could do so in their strategic reserve of North Vietnam before sending them to South Vietnam. On the other hand, the United States was simply too strong to lose. The VC was fighting a classic insurgency warfare, but the U.S. was simply too powerful to lose outright. The U.S., if it wanted to, could have kept pouring money and men and whatnot into Vietnam, basically for as long as it wanted to. This raises the other main problem, is in a war like this, whether it wanted to is the key question. The Vietnam War, like any insurgency war, like Iraq has been at a lot of points, certainly like Algeria was in the 50s, and the Philippines was in the early 20th century, it's as much a political war, was as much a political war as it was a military war. And so really, the way that the North Vietnamese and the VC could be most effective was in breaking America's will at home. America could keep pouring men and material and weapons into the Vietnam War as long as it wanted to. Well, if that's the case, then the key is to make America stop wanting to. The North Vietnamese had a fairly easy task in doing this because the war became extremely unpopular at home, aided by television and the broadcasting of really gruesome, grisly images into American living rooms. The Vietnam War was called the first television war, and the images that they showed from battle scenes, they would not show on TV today. The BBC, there's no way the BBC would show footage from Iraq akin to what it showed from Vietnam. People being literally shot on the evening news, the 6 o'clock news. And it shocked Americans. It shocked Americans, and it made them decide, is this the kind of war we want to support? One of the most famous instances on television was a CBS News reporter following around a platoon, and they came across a hamlet, a small village in South Vietnam. And all of the houses in these hamlets were, as they were in all of South Vietnam, they aren't today, but they were back then, were wooden huts with a thatched roof, with dried palm leaves and that sort of thing. And a tactic, these villages, these rural villages, were mostly supportive to the Viet Cong. And a favorite tactic, American tactic, was to go into the village and basically destroy the village, to deny the VC a base of support, deny it shelter, food, water, that sort of thing. And a favorite tactic then was for the platoon to go in and to Zippo the village. So they would take a Zippo lighter and set the roof of the thatched hut on fire, and they would do that to each hut, one after the other. And the CBS camera crew was following around this platoon, and it captured the platoon doing this, and they weren't trying to hide it. And the platoon leader, as he was lighting the roof of one of these thatched huts with women and children around him crying and begging him not to do it, this is their home, that sort of thing, as he lights it, he tells the camera, we have to destroy the village in order to save it. And if you're sitting in your living room in Topeka, Kansas, or Champaign, Illinois, or even New York City, this kind of war doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. What are we fighting this war for? Especially politically, because the South Vietnamese ally doesn't seem like a very worthy ally. It's still repressive, it's still corrupt. So we're supposed to be fighting for democracy in Vietnam, but we're supporting an authoritarian ally, and we're doing this to civilians. It just doesn't seem like a war that we want to support. Henry Kissinger once said that in guerrilla warfare, the guerrilla wins by not losing, and the great power loses by not winning. The longer the war goes on, the more civilians become involved, the more dirty compromises the great power has to make by targeting civilians. It's almost inevitable that if you try and bomb some insurgents who are hiding among civilian populations, you're going to be bombing civilians as well, and you're going to turn the civilian population against you. So the guerrilla wins by not losing, and the longer the war goes on, the better for the guerrilla forces. The United States may not have been, or it may have been too strong to lose and not strong enough in the right areas to win, but the North Vietnamese were also not strong enough to win. But that just suited them fine. It didn't have the firepower to launch a knockout blow against the United States. It came close in 1968 with the Tet Offensive, Tet, T-E-T, being the Vietnamese Lunar New Year. This is a simultaneous offensive across all of South Vietnam. These little fire flashes were VC attacks pretty much simultaneously. So effective in Saigon that they breached the U.S. compound, the embassy compound. They breached the walls, got into the embassy building, killed a bunch of soldiers. The equivalent would be as if Al-Qaeda broke into the Green Zone in Baghdad and went into the U.S. embassy and killed a bunch of Americans. U.S.